look through the Sedrit. It lists a number of names and the generations, and we'll see shortly why. We'll see there's a very good reason why the Torah lists the various generations from Noah until Avram. We're taught that there were 10 generations from Adam until Noah, and there were 10 generations from Noah till Avram. Now, we know after Avram, you had Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and then you had Moshe. And Moshe wrote the Torah. So we would think that from Moshe, looking all the way back to Adam HaRishon, how would Moshe know what occurred in the time of Adam HaRishon? So it must really, we'd say, be hearsay. You know how it could go through so many different people. But actually, when you look at the chronological order, the sequence, you see that from the time of Adam until the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, it was a very short time. Now, this is going to come out in our discussion. Chapter 11 is the story of the Tower of Babel that occurred after the flood. We know that the people, as it says, the people gathered together. If we'll take a look and just review the simple text. It says that chapter 11, sentence 1, the entire nation, the entire earth, was of one language and of uniform words. What is the meaning, one language and uniform words? Safa achas, dvorim achladim. Now, Hirsch says that safa, meaning the speech, they may have had various tongues, meaning various dialects. They spoke with a southern or a midwestern accent, but the border, the safa, the words, the language was the same. Dvorim achodim, meaning they had the same interpretation for each item. The same word was used. The language was the same, and the name of each item was the same. Because we really are puzzled, how did the world develop into, if we all come from one man, how do we end up with so many different languages? So here, Hirsch is telling us, in the interpretation of the beginning of chapter 11, where it says the entire nation at this time was Sofa Echos Udvorim Achladim. They were totally unified. And it says in the sentence 2, Vahi Benosom Mikedem, and it was as they journeyed from the east, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Now they journeyed from the east. Who were those that journeyed from the east? Hirsch says, first of all, the east always refers to that which is older, creation. Creation, we say, the sun comes up physically from the east. Spiritually, the east has the wisdom and so on. So as our sages said, Minosa Mikedem, they went away Mikadmeine Shalelom. They went away from the early teachings of the fathers. That means younger people, and they wanted to make their own life. Now, there were other people living at that time. Not everybody moved away. At that time, Noah was living. Noah was still living. And Avram Avinu was living. In fact, Avram Avinu was 58 years old. Now, obviously, Avram Avinu is not going to join this group that undertook to build the Tower of Babel. Because, as we'll see, their intentions were not the best. They were rebelling against God. We know Avram, Shem, Noah, these were all considered people who were tzaddikim, who were righteous people. Well, actually, they stood in Eretz Yisrael. They didn't go along with these. As the Mephoshim speak out, they didn't have the power at that time to dissuade them. So therefore, they really didn't participate in this. But the one who led this was the famous Nimrod. We may speak about him. He's mentioned in chapter 10. He was like a totalitarian leader, and he wanted to make a new society. So he led these people away from Avram and Noah. Now, when we speak about Avram and Noah, just to get a perspective chronologically, we know that Adam HaRishon lived 900 years. And we know that Noah lived 960 years. The Tower of Babel took place in the year 2000, as we see. Now, actually, Noah died after the Tower of Babel. Now, you'll say, yeah, but how did Noah know what took place in the time of Automarishan, just between us? How did Noah know what took place in the time of Automarishan? How much of a lapse do you think there was between the life of Noah and the life of Automarishan? There was only about 140 years in between. So from the time that Automarishan died until the time that Noah was born, there was maybe 140 years. So this comes out that you can't really hide too much in 140 years. There were the people that saw Adam. They knew the story of the creation of the world. They knew the story of Gan Eden. When you live 900 years, we have now five generations living at one time. You could have a grandfather and a great-great-grandchild, even in the small space of 100 years of life. So 10 generations doesn't mean thousands of years, especially when you live 900 years and the second party lives 900 years. So Automarishan, I mean, that's nothing. 10 generations doesn't mean that generation died and the generation lived and the generation died. If you have a great-great-grandchild, you already have five generations. If I knew my great-great-grandfather and I have a great-great-grandchild, I have already nine generations. I mean, it's not a big thing, 10 generations in time. So don't forget Adam till Noah to transmit the events that happened at the time of creation was a very simple thing. Now you'll say, yeah, but from after Noah, from the time of the flood. Well, when you go after Noah, from the time of the flood, let's say till Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu knew Noah. At the time of the tower, both Avram Avinu and Noah were living. So all of a sudden we have Avram Avinu knowing from Noah what occurred in the flood and hearing directly what occurred in the creation. Then we have, historically, then we have Yaakov Avinu from Avram Avinu. That was nothing, of course. Yaakov lived together in Avram Avinu. And then Moshe, to accept from Yaakov the information, was not a big thing. That was a very short period of time. So when Moshe wrote the Torah in Sinai, at the most you were dealing with four or five people that it had to be transmitted. It was not a whole story of who knows how many people. So this, the Rambam and the Kuzari emphasize this fact, and they say this is very important. And that's why the Torah goes into the details of telling us the lifespan of each one. And these are these generations, and these are these generations. So when these people were searching for a new road, I mean, it wasn't like they're looking thousands of years later. Thousands of years later, historically, they're re-examining, you know, and I don't believe it, and all of this old-fashioned is only hearsay or surmising. That's not true. Because, really, this was, Noah was there. Noah could tell them what Automarishan told them. So there was no question as to the validity. They didn't have the excuse, perhaps, that we have today. Yet they sought a new way of life. They sought a new introduction. In fact, Hirsch emphasizes, too, Vahi ben Nosom Mikedem. Their intent was not to go to a special place, because then it would say, Vayisu, they traveled. But it says, Vahi binosom, it was when they traveled. Binos, get out of here. Let's go out for ourselves. Where they'll go, that doesn't matter. But the main thing is, binosom mikedem would be to move away. Shem, Noach, like he says, they remained in the east. There was the beginning and the foundation, the development of mankind. What did they want? They wanted to show that man has empowered, that man can go ahead and he could make his own life. He doesn't have to, he could start from scratch, meaning he could build himself. If a person can do, he has faith that he could accomplish everything. So they're going to show, if man will only get together, there's nothing that is held back from them. They found a plain, and in this plain there were no building materials, there was nothing. Yet they made bricks and on their own, and they were able to construct and to build a society. The main thing is they had a strong faith in the ability of people to reach out and to accomplish whatever they want to accomplish. Hirsch explains, like as an introduction, he says, if we look at what we're told here in the story, it is more necessary to pay attention to every detail. Why? Because our sages have remarked, while at the Mabul, the beginning of the chapter, the sin is clearly told us that the people were full of chomers, were full of violence. But here at the Dor HaFloga, he says, it is not definitely said what they did or why God had displeasure. Now he goes into a great detail as to what the sin was. We'll go back to it shortly, just for the narrative, the story you're all acquainted with. They had one language, they built this tremendous tower, God went down to see what they were doing, and then he felt that it was detrimental and he dispersed them. The Torah, in fact, is very vague as to what their sin is. Hirsch gives us a detailed interpretation as to what the sin is. The Malbim, to the contrary, the Malbim says the Torah really doesn't tell us because this wasn't the purpose of telling us what their sin was. So what was the whole purpose of relating this whole chapter according to the Malbim? So the Malbim says there was a very interesting purpose, he says. Let me read you a quote from the Malbim on sentence 7, when God says, let us go down and see what's happening. He says, the Torah did not at all provide an adequate account of the events of the Bavel generation. He says, also to be understood why the narrative follows immediately with this is the line of Shem. As soon as it finishes the narrative that they confused the people and the Tower of Bavel was destroyed, it says, therefore, this was called Bavel, because they were babbling, they didn't understand each other's tongue, Kishom Bolol Hashem Sfas Kol HaOretz, because there God confused them, and from there they were dispersed. Immediately after that it starts, these are the descendants, in sentence 10, of Shem. So he says, is there any reason why in the same proximity, almost in juxtaposition, they put the Tower of Bavel, then right afterwards, this is the line of Shem. It sees that's a genealogical question, which really adds nothing, the line of Shem telling us what significance that has had to strengthen our emunah. Why was it necessary to tell us this is the line of Shem? But then he goes further and he says that a look, however, more penetrating look, says that there are two aspects of the present narrative, when taken together, constitute a true demonstration, like I alluded to earlier, that the Torah is given by God, and a vindication based on principles of what it has disclosed about the creation of the world. He goes into a lengthy discussion. I'm going to paraphrase some of the ideas. He says, numbers of books have been written on the question of the origin of human languages. Are they natural implants into the human being, or is it simply a matter of convention? Each language being the outcome of a consensus among particular people. This we don't know really how language becomes. That's one of the miracles in general in language. Whenever I see one of the little children beginning to talk, how do you explain this? How do you explain this? I mean, all of a sudden it begins to talk. I mean, it's a miracle, but then they're not speaking about this miracle. They're speaking about the various languages. How did they begin? Was it a matter of convention? It was an outcome that people got together and they said, we'll call this this. Particular why certain people call it that way. If you notice, we said, until the Tower of Bavel, Hirsch said they may have spoken with a southern accent because they come from the islands off of the Mediterranean, but they spoke one language. And Dvorim Achadim, Hirsch says they had one concept. Everybody said, this is a bench. Nobody questioned the expression of saying this is a bench. Now this has a lot to do, as we'll see later, with the thoughts and the philosophy and the perspective of the people, if their determination as to what to call something. For example, let me take an example out of context. There is a language after, Hirsch says, after God confused the language. So So people thought differently. It wasn't just that they couldn't converse in the Tower of Babel, but they actually thought differently. For example, he says, let us take the words judge. We'll take a word judge. Now in German, he says, the judge is called a Richter. A Richter means the one who gives things direction, because there is a word Richtung. Richtung means a direction. Now the judge in turn, the Richter, unshaded means separates, right? So this is here and that is here. So the judge unshaded. Now if you'll take Hebrew, says the judge is called Shofet. Shofet comes from uniter. And justice is called Mishpat, the creation of harmonious order, which places everybody where he ought to be in conjunction with the other people. So now he says the question of calling a judge a Richter or a Shofet has to do with your concept of justice. Now, this is how it developed. Before, everybody called him a judge. It may have been a Southern accent, a Boston accent, but it was judge. But after the confusion of language, they couldn't speak the same language. They each have a different approach. I heard last night, like the communist world, the socialist world, somebody was giving the editorial on the news that it's beginning to crumple because people are getting different ideas all of a sudden. This socialist unified that worked so long, communism and so on, is beginning to fall apart all over. He quoted already a communist ideologue that said, in the ideals, there'll have to be a fusion between communism and capitalism. I mean, this is unbelievable. People begin to think different, and therefore a language war. But then you'll say, well, for so many nations, 70 nations, and people to have different languages, how many years did that take to happen? Must have taken ages. How many years could that take to happen? So he says, let's consider this. He says, in the year 3448, just picture that, Moshe comes along, we're speaking the Hebrew calendar, and he tells us that in the year 2656, all of humanity was washed away in a flood. That's how many years? That's a difference of about less than 800 years. About 800 years, say. Moshe tells us in the Torah, 800 years ago there was a flood. Only ones that remained were Noah and his three sons, and they spoke Hebrew. 100 years later, about 700 years ago, he tells us, there was Peleg. And in the generation of Peleg, suddenly within mankind, through God's intervention, 70 different languages appeared. Now they'll say, you just picture this if you make such a statement out in the street today. So people will laugh at you. They'll say, in 700 years before Moshe, they already had 70 nations. In 100 years' time, I mean, how do you know this, Moshe? I mean, it doesn't make sense. So he says, imagine if someone would come along today and insist that 800 years ago, the only inhabitants of our planet were a father and his three sons, and that 700 years ago, there was only one language for all humanity, right? So what would you do immediately? You would expose his lie. You'd go out and you'd find headstones, he says, which are 3,000 years old, cemeteries. And they were written in different languages. So you'll say it's wrong. So clear proof that there were many people, many languages. Now he says, if you look back historically, at the time of Moshe, Egypt was already a great kingdom. And it included scientists, he says, and people of historians. So who would dare to relate such tales about something that happened? Moshe's relating in the time of Egypt's culture, civilized Egypt, something that happened a short time earlier, 700 years. Wasn't he afraid that they'll go out and they'll look and the whole thing would have never been written? I mean, how could he make such statements? He says they would refute him. So he continues, as I mentioned earlier, Avram was 58 years old when Noah died. He knew Noah, he knew Shem and Aver. Yaakov also knew Shem and Aver. He studied in their school. And there were many eyewitnesses who were still around because they lived such long years. So they told their children what they saw, that they lived through this flood. And they remember there were only three of them. and then there was also Peleg, and there was a Tower of Babel, and all of this happened. He says they passed it on to their children. The children of Israel and even Pharaoh and even Mitzrayim knew that these historical facts were true. Just as long as, he says, just as we know that there lived an Alexander the Great and how long he lived. So they knew this. But if Moshe did not write in the Torah the lifespan of everyone from Shem to Avram, then we'll go and say 10 generations and they lived 70 years. I mean, who saw this? Who knew this? No, but he wrote when each one was born and when each one died. And therefore, he said, if he wouldn't have written that, any skeptic could have said that from Shem to Avram went away 2,000 years. And there's no way that Avram actually knew what happened, right? Because, say, each one giving rise to a child when he was 100 or 200 years old, so there was, say, 2,000 years. But that's not true. Because we see from here, if you'll count the times when they were born and how long they lived, you'll know that there were only a few people who lived in between them. So now he says, it comes out that moreover, I mean, according to his cheshbon, Noach, maybe I was wrong a little in my arithmetic, knew Adam. And from him, he had heard about the creation of the world and that it didn't always exist. So what more do you need? There's a chronological map in the back of here, according to the Seder Adaris, how long each one lived and whose life interbound the other. But if you say that, you come out that Noah knew Adam, we're close to it, and Avram knew Noah, clearly it was 58 years in the time of it, and Yaakov surely knew Avram, and Moshe was living with the children, the grandchildren of Yaakov. So how many people had a pass from the time of creation? This is something that we overlook, how important and how significant it is. So now listen what the Malbim concludes. He says, if the Torah did not dwell at length on the sin of the Babel generation, it was because that wasn't the aim of the whole narrative. What do we care what happened there, he says. The main purpose was to disclose the languages, that which we consider unimportant of this chapter. We don't pay heed to this one gave birth to this one and this one spoke that language. We just run through that and get to the Tower of Babel, these 10 sentences, and try to see what the chet was of the Tower of Babel, and we don't heed the other two chapters. The Malbim claims that rather the main purpose was to disclose that the splintering of the languages was an act of God, and that it had happened as little as 700 years before the Torah was revealed at Sinai. For there can be no doubt that the matter was investigated and nothing was found in written documents nor headstones in any language that was older than 700 years. And then he repeats, he says, the Seder Elam, he repeats that Avram was 58 years old and there were only 452 years separated Moshe from the generation of Babel, of the Tower of Babel. And there Noach lived, and Noach knew Adam, so there was no question to the authenticity of the narrative of Bereshis. Then he quotes the Kizari, and he says, this is therefore additional proof that it is all true, as the Kizari says. And since it happened such a short time before, we also understood why the Torah dwelt at such great length on the various nations that then existed, because these nations, after the flood, until the Torah, was less than 1,000 years, so therefore they spoke into detail about these. This I consider to be actual proof. The only way you deny this is if you deny Moshe, the existence of a Moshe, or you deny the existence of, well, the world denies the existence of a Moshe. They deny the existence of a Noah, and they deny the existence of an Adam, in a sense, in a Gan Eden. I mean, they could deny the whole Bereshis. Therefore, this, of course, is no proof. But if we'll accept the fact of the being of Moshe, and Moshe liberating the Jews from Egypt, and Moshe writing this, obviously I can't go out and show this to people who believe that the Torah was composed in later generations, and this is all nothing. But those who have emunah in Torah being written by Moshe, that's the prerequisite, that's the requirement. To have emunah, Torah being written by Moshe. Then we are challenged. Then we are challenged, oh, you believe in 4,000, 3,000, so on. Where did all the languages come from? So I have to be able to answer from my vantage point, if the basic belief is in a creation and in a revelation, I have to be able to give dates and places and reasons why the 70 nations came, the 70 languages came, and how do I know that the 70 nations and the 70 languages came? So this, the Malden is trying to say, is the reason why. But it, of course, it's all prefaced in the, that we accept that Moshe wrote this, and these are the facts that are correct. The only question is, how could they be correct with our understanding? Where did the 70 languages come from? It took thousands. This gives us an explanation why the languages came, how the languages came, and that it didn't take really thousands of years. It was all within this time span. The findings now about prehistoric, I don't know what my feelings are about that. I have very cynical and skeptical feelings about that, because even if I don't believe in religion and everything else, I'd say make up your mind. If I read in 1986 that they found something 100 billion years, and in 1988 all of a sudden they were wrong, they found something 500 billion years, I wouldn't consider that an exact science. I mean, the world doesn't become a few hundred billion years older just for one thing. I mean, all of that I consider to be the finding mean. There were these many layers of carbon is accumulated, or that they always use an example, the ring on the tree. Every year there's another ring, and there's so many rings. But I mean, Adam didn't grow up as a baby either. The world came into existence, beautiful trees in Gan Eden, say. The trees were not little saplings that were just planted by Adam. So the tree, just like Adam lived 1,000 years and was born, who knows, physically a different picture than we have. Adam, the way he looked at birth, in no way looks like, if we take the various midrashim, you would draw a different kind of a creature. He was so big and so tall, and according to the famous Medrash, he had nails all over him when he was born, nails. And in fact, afterwards, when he says he was naked, is because he lost his armor of nails. And the nails only remained on the tips of your fingers. It's one of the reasons why we have the power of tumah on the nail, and we wash our nails and so on, negelvas. But the idea was that this change took place in Adam. It also says physically he was totally changed. He was totally a different creation. Now, the chicken before the egg, or the egg before the chicken? Perhaps the chicken was born a full flesh after the flood. It says that I no longer will curse man. And he says, Eid kol yemei ha'oretz, all the days of the earth shall be there perpetually. Zera, there will be seed time, right, and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease from working. So he explains the following, that is usually taken to mean that during the time of the flood, normally you say, The course of time, day and night, and seasons were disturbed. And here, the resolution is declared that just like there'll never be a total destruction, the regular course of time will never be disturbed. So he says this would assume that in the period before the flood, the change of seasons as we know it now was in existence. But he says it's not true. The traditions which have been handed down to us speak against this supposition. In fact, he says, do also the opinions of modern geologists in his time and students of research. He says, Wells quotes authorities who have arrived at conclusions which agree remarkably with Reb Yitzchak. Who is this Reb Yitzchak? The Medrash says that before the floods, the fields had only to be cultivated every 40 years. As eternal springtime rain, the seasons never changed. It said, Hoyelohem avir yofe kemina pesach ado atzeres. The temperature was constant and moderate. The continents were also not split asunder, so that there was easy communication throughout the world. Like hoyu mahalchin misofo elam vatsof, you could actually walk from one side to another, and they lived a long time, 900 years, they had plenty of time to walk. Now you gotta take a jet. But there, the idea was that they had plenty of time, and they could actually walk all around. The seasons of the years, he said, mentioned in our verse, are definitely to be post-diluvian innovations. Mikan ve'elach, after the flood, you have Zerah, Vikotzir, Vikor, Vechom, different seasons. Not only did the world change, that no longer is connected. Now, he jokingly said, Reb Shmuel Bar Nachman used to suffer from headaches in thundery weather. So he said, see why we have to thank the age of the flood. Our sinus conditions and allergies, we have to thank them because the climatic stability, which was before, he says, is quoted as being a cause. Not only that, why did God change? Because that was a cause of the slackness in generation. Why? Like the Medrash says, what made them act in such a terrible manner? Because they didn't have what to do. They used to plant once in 40 years and they had enough food. They used to live forever. And then they became bored with life. So they had to try new things. So he said, these climatic conditions, the cause of the longevity, which prevailed, as well as the alter conditions afterwards, was this shortage duration of life. So the conditions brought about the change of life. Now the change of life has to do why God made his pact, because since life changed, so if one generation is no good, so 100 years later, the other generation changes. They die out, they get others. So what do we see? Tremendous change, call it volcanic or whatever, that took place, everything possible that you could call it, during the flood, that the carbon and all this definitely could have occurred during there. There is such a total change from the actual creation. That's the way Hirsch says in this. Purna, I believe, says things. The Nephilim, for example, in the time of Yoshua, in the time of Moshe, when they came to Eretz Israel, they still had from the original Nephilim, Anokim, Bnei Anokim. They were giants that these people have never seen in their life, such giants. They were tremendous. So they were living yet from the generations earlier. So there was no question that the climate had a difference and all of this came about. But what you see here also was, he brings down from geologists, the idea of the splitting of the continents and of the various islands and so on. All of this took place later. So to answer these questions, you could answer them. The main question, though, like the Malbim says, is only an answer. We just have to give this. I can't go out and take an agnostic and tell him, oh, I proved it all. I mean, so you'll say this was written who knows when. The main answer is for us, in a sense, when we do believe in that, and then we have questions, how did the languages, why did the languages develop? How does Moshe really know this? Where to say? So here, can it be refuted? So here we have this in the Torah. There are many things in the Torah. When the Torah makes an example of how many different kind of fish and different kind of animals and so on, that these dinim have never, by biologists, they have never had any rebuttal or any contrary evidence to this. And, Torah says only this one has a split off and so on. They've never discovered anything contrary to that. And these are absolute truths. So this is something that the Malbim is emphasizing, and of course the Kuzari and the Rambam also says it, that the idea is that this was an absolute truth. You want a pragmatic way that it happened, fine. These are the people that lived this long, and he saw him, and Moshe was only a little bit away from Adam Arishan, so there was no question that he knew all of this. This takes care of these questions. But the Malbim has an interesting thought. So all of this Tower of Babel was only brought in because to teach us the authenticity of the Torah. But there are so many other commentaries which are worth bringing in. Some of them will raise eyebrows. The earlier Midrashim, when they speak of the Tower of Babel, the Chet, is we find, for example, the Ramban and others in the Chazal also. I mean, the Chazal say that the idea was that this was a question of Avodah Zarah. And they go into Kabbalistic ideas of severing the relationship of God or the dominion of God over the world. All of these things, which of course we don't really understand what they mean. But the Ramban says that without any question. The idea of the words "Venase lonu Shem," let us make for ourselves a name. We will be the Shem. We will be the name. We will be the power. The Sipurna goes a little bit further and says Nimrod, who was the initiator of this entire movement, he wanted to be a god. In fact, what was his greatness? It said in the previous chapter that Nimrod captured the people. Uhecheo, the term used by Nimrod, is how did he capture the imagination of the people? It says Cush, we know, who was a descendant, grandson of Noah. Cush yolad es Nimrod. He gave birth to Nimrod, chapter 10, sentence 8 and 9. Uhecheo lios gibor boorets. He was the one who began to be the strong man in the land. Now, there were many strong people in the land. Why does it say he began? But the idea was that up to then, there was no reigning monarch. The Ramban speaks out that he became the monarch. Before him, there were Nephilim, there were powerful people, but every family lived under the authority of its own patriarch. He became the first monarch, and he prevailed over the Babylonian people that they should crown him to be the king, the whole idea of a king. That's what it's in sentence, the next sentence in 10. Vati reishis mamlachte Bavel. The original place of his kingdom was in Bavel. How did he prevail? So it says in sentence 9, Hu hayo gibor tzayid, he was a mighty hunter before God. Therefore it is said that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before God. Now the Malbim explains that there were so many wild beasts then. Don't forget the world wasn't populated yet. And the people were actually in terror of these wild beasts. Now Nimrod showed them that he could protect them, and there's a way to gain a dominion by hunting down these animals. And by the fact that he excelled, the Malbim says, in hunting, so that made him a great person, and they all followed him. Now, there's the famous Medrash. Why was he so famous, and why was he so able to hunt down the animals? So I'm sure you heard before that when the garments that Hashem provided for Adam and Chava, it says immediately after that, when God last week said that Hashem had to make garments for them. So it said that the garments that he provided, that went on as an inheritance, it went on to Cush. Now Cush gave those garments to Nimrod. They were embroidered with animals and birds. Now, when he put them on, he was able to get some strength, it was endowed with strength, and all the beasts, birds and animals, crouched before him, so he had no difficulty in catching them. This was like a divine protection. Sounds a little bit odd. Adam HaRishon also had this divine protection. Perhaps that's why when he was naked, God gave him not only the physical clothes, but it was also a way of guarding him that his dominion over the beasts and the animals, although he had sinned, he had endangered the beasts and the animals. So this was his protection. But he was a Gibor Tzayid, Lifnei Hashem, that they tempted him not in place of God, but as a God. Lifnei Hashem, he should be another deity in place of God. And according to this Medrash we just quoted, they wanted him, because of this greatness, they wanted to make him to build him a castle in heaven where he could live up in heaven. So this idea was of Avodah Zarah. There are other approaches which are much more modern. Now this began in the modern time, you'll say, it's not Midrashim or early Rishonim. We'll go back to Rabbi Yonasan and Eibeshitz, who was still a nice few hundred years. Now, they want to give it in a natural means. For example, even the Rabbeinu Bechaya yet, who was the time of the Ramban, that's 1,200, maybe when, 1,100 years. So he explained it perhaps that they were afraid, the flood is over with, they were afraid that they'll come down and destroy them with a heavenly fire. So he says this was somehow supposed to contain the heavenly fire, just like you make something to catch the lightning, a lightning rod. They felt that physically this would be a salvation, that this tremendous tower, that the heavenly fire would not be able to envelop and destroy man. That's the way the Rabbeinu Bechaya offers this. Reb Yonasan and Eibeshitz even goes further, and he says that the idea was that the people wanted to reach the moon. And if they'll reach the moon, they'll be able to have a moon station, and this will, scientifically, they'll be able to control the nature. And therefore, they won't have to worry about natural. That's a thought that he put forth. The Emek David in its seed wants to say that it had military purposes. It was to spy on what's going on in this earth. And that's why it was like a satellite, according to the Netziv. So the idea was they were afraid, pen nor futs. That's what it says in the sentence. Let us go and build a city, how does it say, in the heaven. Why? Pen nor futs, because we will be spread out. They were afraid that the people will not remain here. Right? If they remain here, there will be peace. But they were afraid as they build up, instead of building out, they'll move to the suburbs. You know, instead of building the metropolises, the skyscrapers. And then, pen nor futs, they were afraid that they'll get, strangers, and this will bring to war. So this will be for reconnaissance. So that's why they were punished, and it says, Vayechdalu libnei soyir, which is really unbelievable. I mean, that a few hundred years ago. I know when we were young, before they even spoke about these things, we'd say some kind of a tower where they could see what's going on, and we had no concept of that. But yet, in our decades, in the last two decades, we see that there's space travel interplanetary. It has Reagan's space curtain for purposes of defense. Now they say in Israel even put up this reconnaissance, and they'll be able to know what's going on in each country. All of these things were offered already as interpretations more to our knowledge. The Abarbanel has another idea. Abarbanel says, and this is interesting, that this civilization, they were going too far against the will of God. Now this is debatable, obviously, but it's an interesting idea for him to put forth. He's not exactly orthodox in many approaches that he puts forth. In the way people think, he's novel in that. He wants to say, he's orthodox in it, novel in his ideas. He wants to say that people were supposed to live a life with nature. That means they're supposed to work the field and live a very simple life. Simple life. In fact, the Malbim also interprets the words Dvorim Achodim. Hirsch says, Dvorim Achodim, similar concepts in language, meaning everybody thought the same way, like I gave an example before. But the Malbim says, Dvorim Achodim means they didn't have such large vocabularies or such large dictionaries. They only had to know a few words. They had a very simple life. They lived a simple life. It's interesting also, the Amish, for example, by them living the simple life is their religion. The Abarbanel said that really they were supposed to live the desire of God that people should live a simple life. And the sin was, he says, by the fact that they moved away, and this could also fit in, moving away mikedem from previous generations, and they tried the advancement of technology and so on, and the civilization, and the desire to gather more possessions, and wealth, and robbery, and murder, all of this came about. And when they were farmers out in the field, nothing happened. I mean, out in the farm, you were able to keep your front door open at night. In the cities, you can't. There's a big difference in the way the farmer looks at it. And he says that was the sin. And also he goes further. In the time when they lived a simple life, everybody had things equally. There was a certain social idea that nobody had, like a moshav, lehoya lo adam proti nachlo, boots. Nobody had their own things. Velei dover echad proti l'shimushay. Everybody used everything. Kamei haloshim. But once they started building and constructing and so on, that alienated the relationship one from the other, and each one began to find possessions, and this brought shali shali v'shalach shalach. And that brought about, he says, a separation. Now you'll say, but the whole Torah is based on all the different laws regarding ownership, regarding building, regarding all of this. So he says further, if that's the case, he says, why didn't God forbid it? Like make a religion like the Amish, you can't drive cars, you're not allowed to wear ties. I mean, why didn't he forbid this? So he says, because when Hashem saw that this was the world, that they were involved in the Taivis Amoslios Venitmu Behem, meaning that they got that the entire nations, all the nations of the world, were so immersed and involved in the various wealth and desires for different things, so he didn't forbid the Jews of the Bnei Yisrael to partake of that. But what he did, he warned them and he encouraged them that they should do all of this under the proper path. That means you could live a life, a Torah life, which really governs and sanctifies everything. You don't have to live like a Porush. This goes back to a basic idea that in Judaism, once the Torah was given to us, it was given that every aspect, even the worst things, can be sanctified. In fact, this gives us, like some learn the idea of slavery. The Torah didn't say that slavery is good, or that you should have slaves. But speaking of such a society and such a civilization, it put it in perspective how it can serve a proper purpose. And the way we've spoken about in the past, what it does was to take those people who were Nefush and lift them up eventually to reach the level of a Ben Shem. So it's using slavery, which was, but not that the Torah advocates slavery. Shechita also, in a sense, if the Torah says to shech, it's not that it's a mitzvah that you have to eat meat. It's saying that if you eat meat, so then you should do it in this way, which is not callous and not cruel. So, but really, it was not meant, he says, we were meant, or God's desire, and if you go back to what Adam HaRishon was in Gan Eden, the desire was there that he should be living that type of a simple life without all the needs, but according to our choice, this is the situation we ended with. So these are some of the additional reasons given for the Tower of Babel. There are many, many reasons. The interesting point is that almost every reason hits the nail on the head. Almost every reason has a lesson for us to be able to derive and a message for us.